we rarely make the link that our anxiety, our hypervigilance, our depression is connected to our parents and our grandparents. We just think we're wired this way. Memories of trauma are somehow imprinted in our parents and grandparents, sperm cells and egg cells. And then this information is passed forward to us. And then as a result, we can be born with altered brains that are preparing us biologically to cope with traumas that are similar to the traumas our parents or grandparents experience.
Welcome to Salish Wolf, a podcast bringing you inspirational stories of extraordinary endeavors. I am your host, Todd Howard. Just south of my Vancouver Island home is a tiny archipelago on which for nearly a decade lived a most astonishing animal, a lone wolf. Takea, as he would be named, survived and thrived in an environment where likely no wolf had ever set foot. In the process, he captured the hearts of a community and showed us even the most unlikely is possible. His story is not dissimilar to those of the individuals interviewed on this podcast. At some point, they each had to turn to their inner lone wolf. From there, they were able to lead and inspire. My intention is to share their journeys to help you discover your own inner greatness and peace. This podcast is brought to you by Anchor Point Expeditions, where I provide life-changing personal leadership retreats for men, coaching, and other valuable personal growth resources. Visit anchorpointexpeditions.com to see where your journey could take you. Mark Wolin is an expert on inherited family trauma and the author of the book, It Didn't Start With You. His research and perspectives on trauma provide immense opportunities for healing, not just for the individual, but for generations to come. By understanding where we have come from and the baggage that we carry, we can live with fewer emotional burdens today and break cycles that might sabotage our future and that of our offspring. I cannot more strongly recommend Mark's book, and we explore many of its concepts in this interview. We begin with the notion of inherited family trauma and the direct biological link of at least three family generations, and energetically of many more. Another major topic is attachment trauma, and we discuss how a break in the mother bond at any stage of childhood development can have massive reverberations in adulthood and potentially through the family lineage. In his book and clinical practice, Mark explores core language and how it can serve as a map through our family history to the root of traumas. Mark also takes us along his personal journey into a debilitating condition that catalyzed his global travel in search of healers and healing. What he eventually discovered shocked him and sent him back to his childhood home to renegotiate his relationship with his parents. There, a hug from his mom helped not only to initiate his healing, but also helped to shape his clinical practice. And we talk about the power of hugs in therapy. We also talk about his work in family constellations and assess the global traumas of the pandemic that are affecting all of us. Through his work and writing, Mark elegantly lays out possible paths to recovery and has helped countless break the cycle of suffering. This is a practical, eye-opening, and inspirational interview that has the potential to serve all of humanity. Please enjoy this episode of Salish Wolf with Mark Wolin. Mark, welcome to Salish Wolf.
Thank you for having me, Todd.
It's great to finally connect with you. I know we've been plotting this for a while, and thank you for your patience while we managed to do this. We've already started chatting before we hit record here, so pretty excited about the episode. I will just start by saying that I first learned about you through your book, It Didn't Start With You, which is an incredible book. I'm sure I'll talk about it much more during the podcast, but I just want to highly recommend it to anyone and everyone. And at the core of this book is basically the concept that trauma doesn't begin with us. It begins generations before. And so as I read through your book, I'm constantly sharing excerpts with my wife, or in my head, I'm thinking, oh, this reminds me exactly of this person, or this explains this thing. And it just feels like it's such a beautifully researched book and well-written, and everything just seems to, when I read it, it's just like, yeah, that makes complete sense. And I've read it now a number of times because I keep going back and learning more. Yeah. So let's just start with that concept of family trauma, inherited trauma. is something that we each carry within us. And this, again, going back generations. So if you can kind of set the stage for that and for the rest of our conversation with us. Thank you.
So let's say one of our parents or our grandparents had a significant trauma. They lost their mother or their father when they were young, or maybe our mother or father, they were sent away to be raised by a relative or placed in an orphanage, or maybe one of their siblings died tragically when they were young. An event like this can break the heart of the family. And what we now know is the reaction to the trauma doesn't necessarily stop with the people who experienced it. So the feelings, the sensations, specifically the stress response, the way the genes express, this can pass forward to the children and the grandchildren, affecting them in a similar way, even though they didn't personally experience that trauma. So now there's substantial biological evidence for this that demonstrates this.
What is that biological evidence?
Well, I'll start at the beginning. When a trauma happens, literally it changes us. It causes a chemical change in our DNA. And this can change how our genes function, sometimes for generations. So technically, after this event happens, after this terrible experience happens, a chemical tag or an epigenetic tag will attach to our DNA, and it'll tell our cells, hey, use these genes or ignore these genes, enabling us to better deal with what's happened, the trauma. And then the way our genes are affected will change how we act or feel. For example, we can become sensitive or reactive to situations that are similar to the original trauma, even if that trauma occurred in a previous generation, so that we have a better chance of surviving it in this generation. I'll give you an example, Todd. If our grandparents came from a war-torn country, so people are being shot, bombs are going off, bullets are flying, uniformed men are lining people up in the square, people are being taken away, imprisoned. Our grandparents, witnessing it or experiencing it, would develop and pass forward a skill set, a particular skill set. Now, this skill set can have good things attached to it, sharper reflexes, quicker reaction times, reactions to the violence to help them survive this trauma that they're experiencing. But the problem is, now they're passing forward this same skill set, and here we are inheriting a stress response with the dials set to 10, prepared for this war, this catastrophe, these uniformed men ready to take us away, and we live in the suburbs. So here we are preparing for this catastrophe that never arrives. And we rarely make the link that our anxiety, our hypervigilance, our depression is connected to our parents and our grandparents. We just think we're wired this way.
And when you say epigenetic, I'm sure most listeners are familiar with that, but can you give a bit of a definition for what epigenetic is?
Sure. So when we're talking about epigenetic, around above the genes, we're talking that the genome doesn't change, the sequence doesn't change, but the way the genes express, that changes. For example, memories of trauma are somehow imprinted in our parents and grandparents' sperm cells and egg cells. And then this information is passed forward to us. And then as a result, we can be born with altered brains that are preparing us biologically to cope with traumas that are similar to the traumas our parents or grandparents experience.
Mm-hmm. And when you speak about egg cells, in biologically speaking, the egg cells of a of a fertile woman were actually in her mother. At how does that work? At like the time of her mother's birth.
When our grandmother's pregnant with our mother.
Yes.
And I love that you're bringing this up because it's such a strong image. When our grandmother is pregnant with our mother, our mother's egg cells, one of which will become us, are already embedded, already in her womb when she's a fetus. So yes. when our mother is 5 months a fetus, the cell line, the egg cell line stops dividing. So all the eggs she'll ever have, one of which will be us, is already in our mother's womb, inside our grandmother's womb. So if you look at it in that way, if you think about the traumas grandma's going through, she loses grandpa, she doesn't have any money, she loses another child, her traumas, if you now add in the work of Bruce Lipton, who talks about a mother's emotions can biologically imprint the baby and alter the genetic expression. If you bring those two things together, grandma's traumas are affecting mom as a baby, as we know from the work of Rachel Yehuda, when she talked about the pregnant mothers who were at or near the World Trade Center when it was attacked, and those babies going on to have 16 different genetic markers and being smaller for their gestational age. And, it's so interesting and convoluted, but really simple at the same time, that our grandmom's traumas, her feelings, her emotions affect her fetus. And here we are inside that fetus as an egg.
Mm-hmm. It's such a vivid image of three generations right there are interlocked, intertwined.
Yeah, and absolutely.
So it's so easy to see that link, that what happened two generations before us is still affecting us today. And I think you can even go a step further in knowing that grandma is responding based on how she knows and how she's been programmed to respond, which goes back to great grandma and great great grandma. So really, like this family tree of trauma, the roots just run so deeply. And is that in part why First Nations often speak of doing things for the next seven generations? Do you think part of that is at the root of that, this concept that we are all interconnected and for generations?
I do, because even if, in science, and when you look at the science, they can show a link for three or four generations. So they can take baby mice and traumatize them in a lab and look at their biology and see that there's a molecular changes for three or four generations. But if those of us who are stressed, the traumas continue to repeat, it's almost, Freud even noticed this when he talked about repetition compulsion, that the traumas keep repeating, seeking a better outcome. So we know that if we can look back three generations, the question that comes to our mind is, well, what happened even before that? Why do these traumas keep repeating? When did it start, really? Like the title of the book, It Didn't Start With Us. You're right, it could have started seven generations ago and have been affecting generations ever since. I work a lot with attachment trauma. And what we know is if our mother didn't receive a lot from her mother, when she turns to us, she can't give what she didn't receive. And we can find this mother wound often extending back several generations. I'm the inherited trauma guy, but I would tell you I would spend 75-85% of the time working with attachment wounds because they're also heritable. In fact, when you look at trauma language, you can even discern when, I know I'm jumping all over the place, Todd, but in my book, I teach the reader to listen to the words he or she says. I ask many questions in the book. One of the questions is, tell me your worst fear. What's the worst thing that could happen to you? If things suddenly fall apart, if things go terribly wrong, what's the worst thing that could happen to you? And the answer to that question, I call the core sentence. Now, to break that down further, There are two types of core sentences. One is generational, and I'll give you an example of that. I'll do something terrible. I'll hurt a child. I'll go crazy. I'll be locked up. I'll be ostracized. I'll be hated. You can hear the generational quality of those sentences. But then there's another type of sentence that comes out. I'll be abandoned. I'll be rejected. I'll be alone. I'll be helpless. I'll be alone, powerless, rejected. And those sentences have an attachment quality. And so when I work with attachment, it doesn't even necessarily have to be our attachment with our mother. It can be our mother's attachment with her mother, our father's attachment with his mother, our grandmother's attachment with her mother, and so on and so forth.
The family dynamic is, I think it's universal in its omnipresence in everybody's life. Every man who I work with, there's always, including myself, there's always some sort of trauma that is connected to parents. And until we heal that wound, we are going to continue to perpetuate it and probably project it out onto others. And that can also go back to the grandparents as well. But that those core wounds are so important to get to the bottom of, so we can see why it is that we react the way that we're reacting. And why is it that most people aren't even aware that they're projecting onto others. But if you can get to that step of knowing that everyone is just a mirror to me and my projections, if we can get there, I think it's such a helpful way to at least take ownership. And if we take ownership and claim responsibility, then we're so much more empowered to actually
very well said
process it.
Very well said, Todd. And you know, that's why I wrote, well, it's one of the reasons I wrote the book. People, we don't understand why we are the way we are. Many of us, you know, we walk around and with an anxiety, a depression, an obsessive thoughts, phobias, and we just think we're wired this way. We don't connect it. We don't understand maybe some of our attachment traumas because they began too early, pre-hippocampal, before our hippocampus was able to make connections with our prefrontal cortex. So we don't have a cognitive memory of what happened in utero or when we were one or two or three, but we have a somatic memory. And then it goes even beyond that. There's historical memory that passes to us through gene expression. So in the book, what I try to do is I take the airport reader, to use a phrase, you know, somebody who is just walking through an airport and picks up my book in the airport bookstore, take the airport reader and bring us to a place of becoming a detective. So we can become detectives of what we say, what we do, how we behave, how we feel, and then try to connect this language, this either verbal language or this behavioral language, to the originating trauma. So just like you said, we can then become free. We can be more empowered. We can have the freedom to realize what happened and then how to take the healing steps, which, as you know, is the last part of my book. But I'll just say part one, you become a detective and you listen to your verbal and your nonverbal trauma language. The second part of the book, we learn how to link it. We do our genogram, our traumagram, and we link it in our family tree or to our early history, our early environment. And then the third part of the book is how we heal, how right. We have images and experiences that change our brain.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to assume you're familiar with the work of Harville Hendricks and Helen Hunt in
yes.
Imago Therapy and their book,
yes.
Getting the Love That You Want. It's different concepts, and yet there's some similarity in the sense that the wounds that we carry with us from particular those wounds, the broken bonds between parent and child, those are things that we will perpetuate on and seek out partners who will help to continue that experience until we wake up to it and actually heal the wound. And so it's I think there's just this I guess I'm speaking again towards this empowerment of realizing that there's so much that we can do no matter how we're wired, no matter how many generations this runs deep. There are ways that we can recognize that we actually can take control of the situation and begin to heal and take the steps to heal. And that's one of the great things about your book. As you said, in part three, it really maps out how to deal with that. And in part two, it allows us to figure out why these things are even present in us.
Yeah, and I love what you said about partners, because we sometimes I give a piece of homework with our partner. I'll have us hug our partner for 20 minutes. We'll set a clock for 20 minutes. And within that 20 minutes, our somatic wound, our unconscious wound, our attachment trauma, our inherited trauma will begin to show up in our body. So for example, in the middle of the hug, we might tell our partner, "This is strange. I love you. I love hugging you, but I'm noticing my throat is tightening, or my pectoral muscles are beginning to close over my heart and I feel armored in my chest, or I feel numb at my solar plexus, or I feel in my womb area. I can't feel anything." And then we ask our partner, "Could you please put your hand here and tell me these words? I've got you, and I've got this young part of you, and I'll breathe with you until this young part of you comes back online or feels safe or feels more, trusts me or is no longer tight." And so couples will do this. They'll trade off. You know, the first person hugs and says, "Can you put your hand here and tell me you've got me and you've got him, this young part of me that's beginning to reveal himself in this hug?" And then we switch and we trade sides. I have people do this twice a week. So the partner can heal us. And I'm glad you brought that up. I love the work of Harville Hendricks. And I believe our partners can help us heal.
What is it about the 20-minute hug that helps to bring that out? I mean, that's an extraordinarily long time to be
absolutely
hugging.
So because with it, because within three minutes, if you figure when you hug somebody, you've got about, 3 to 5 seconds until you say, "Okay, the hug's over. All right, I'm ready to drop the hug." But if you sustain this hug for several minutes, you'll begin to bump into yourself. You'll begin to bump into the parts of yourself that feel, why am I tightening? Why do I feel tight in my pelvic floor? Why do I feel tight in my throat? Why is my abdomen disappearing? Why do I feel numb in this part of my body? Because in that hug, we're not used to hugging for that length of time. We're used to either breaking the hug or then going into making love. But we don't just sustain the hug where we're forced to find ourselves. And in that place, it's such a great exercise. We can help our partners and they can help us find those places in ourselves that are begin to show up because we have attachment trauma or we have inherited trauma.
Right. Now, biologically, I think it's after 20 seconds, oxytocin starts to be released during a hug, the love hormone. And I'm wondering if with these prolonged hugs, if the oxytocin is being released, but then it's being met eventually with our inherited traumas, our resistance perhaps to opening up, or our resistance to vulnerability, or our anxiety. How is that playing?
You got it. It's exactly right. So, you know, many of us bypass our vulnerability by controlling, doing, acting out, or even making love. You know, we just go beyond what's uncomfortable and don't stay with it.
Yeah.
So there's this opportunity to stay with what we find intolerable or uncomfortable. And I found that it will show up for many of us in that sustained hug, because again, that hug forces us to be vulnerable. If we don't go into action, if we don't go into making love or doing or trying to soothe our partner, instead we just be with ourselves in this hug, we might find the golden chalice that we've been looking for, which all along was hidden right underneath our own uncomfortability. And what I'm talking about is being with. So I have this way of describing healing. You know, one of the things I'll say is that, to put it in a nutshell, we need to practice being with the uncomfortable sensations in our body until we reach what's beneath them, which are the sensations we experience as life-giving. Sensations like pulsing, tingling, softening, expanding, blood flowing, waves of energy, waves of warmth, particles swirling, a figure eight, an infinity sign swirling in our body. And we need to be able to be with what's beneath the uncomfortable sensations, which are the life-giving sensations. And then we need to hold those for a chunk of time. I tell people, you know, following the laws of neuroscience, I tell people, if we can hold positive experiences, positive sensations in our body for at least a minute, and then repeat that 6 times a day, that can be enough to change our brain. That can be enough to calm our stress response. That can be enough to downregulate our limbic system. And but it's essential we take time to do that. People often don't take time to do that because when they go, oh yeah, I want to be with positive sensations in my body, they only bump into the uncomfortable sensations and go, oh yeah, I tried that. It didn't work for me.
Right. And I'm also hearing, I think, though, too, is that not just holding these positive sensations, but also holding the negative, holding the tension. I actually, one of my guests who I've interviewed a number of times, Lori Eve Deshar, she's an alchemical healer. And I just was speaking to her last week, and she was talking about this concept of just holding the tension. Don't make any decisions. Yes. Just be with it. Feel it. And once you sit with it for long enough, it does start to ease up a little bit so that you can see what's potentially underneath it. And what's exactly underneath it is this opportunity to, as she says, to turn our lead into gold. But we're such an averse culture to actually sitting in tension that anytime something uncomfortable comes up, our reflex response is, get away. Don't go there. I don't want to see it. I don't want to be there. I don't want to think about it.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's just it. When we can hold these this tension, all of a sudden we'll start to notice. What I often ask people a question. If you weren't just this tension, this tightness, but you were particles of energy, what might these particles of energy be doing in your body? Would they be dense? Would they be moving? Would they be swirling? Would they be going up and down? Which gives people a new lens, a new window to see themselves as more than just where we put our focus, which is what's uncomfortable, what's tight. You know, when we start to do this work with people, they start to twist their necks, the back of their necks are tight, their occiput hurts, you know, they start to feel what's uncomfortable. And as we know, by holding what's uncomfortable, we can get to what's beneath, which is, oh, it's dissolving. Okay, let's follow that. Let's ride this dissolving. Let's ride it as though we become it. Don't just watch it, be it. Follow this dissolving. Let's see what's happening. And when we do practice, somatic practices like that, we can get into this complete melting of the defenses, the strategies, and find our core. And I use this word core in a big way. Often our core is unavailable to us, or the sensation of our core, because we're so defended, we're so strategized, and really we want to live from within this energy of our Eckhart Tolle would call it our inner body, right? And what I'm calling it is our inner core, this energetic experience of ourselves.
In your experience, Mark, is there any way to heal the trauma without being with the discomfort, without sitting?
No. It's okay. So we either inherited, or in our childhood, or in our infancy, or in utero, we develop strategies and defenses to avoid pain. And those strategies are, don't feel this, tighten up, tighten our neck, brace our mid-back, be good, be a good child, be quiet, don't be too much. And these strategies helped us survive. And at the time, they may have been useful, but here as adults, we realize they're blocking us from life force. They're blocking us from love. They're blocking us from vulnerability. So to heal, we've got to have positive experiences that'll change our brain. But then we need to practice the new feelings and the new sensations of these positive experiences. Because when we do this, we not only create new neural pathways in our brain, but we also stimulate the release of feel-good neurotransmitters like serotonin or GABA or dopamine. Dopamine, that's a big driver. Or we stimulate the release of feel-good hormones. You mentioned oxytocin, estrogen, that would be another. And even the very genes involved in our body's stress response, this can begin to function in a new and improved way. In other words, we can change the way our DNA expresses. So yes, in order to have positive experiences, we have to bump into our strategies, our defenses. Don't feel this. Don't let our muscles melt. Don't let our pelvic floor untighten. Don't let our chest unarmor because it's dangerous. Don't trust this person. And that's anathema to the very life force that allows us to have an exalted life of freedom, of love.
Yeah.
Loving someone, being loved, receiving, giving, all that stuff.
And when you say it, don't do these things as we tell ourselves because it's dangerous, that's because at some point in our life, putting up those blockages or those boundaries protected us. It helped us. And yet it may not be helpful now in this situation. Is that
right? It's absolutely well put. As now as we want to love, as now as we want to be leaders in our community, as now as we want to teach our children,
right,
or mentor the younger generation, we ourselves have to walk through it first. We have to be able to pull energy away from our limbic brain, our limbic system, pull traction away from our limbic system, our overactive amygdala, as we know in traumatized people like me. You know, I had to do a lot of work to shrink my amygdala and bring engagement to the forebrain, specifically the prefrontal cortex, where we can integrate our traumatic experiences and our healing experiences, and our brains can change. We know from mindfulness, the studies in mindfulness, that practicing mindfulness actually shrinks our amygdala and thickens our prefrontal cortex.
Mm-hmm. Now, how is it that someone can go into this discomfort, this zone of attention, and not get stuck there? Not get stuck, let's say, in what allopathic medicine would call depression, and being this place where nothing is changing, nothing is shifting. We're just kind of stuck in this quagmire of darkness. And in men's work, it's called the dark night of the soul, which typically is a journey, but how do we make sure we continue through that journey and not get stuck?
I love the question. It brings up such for me, a deep question. So I see healing work as integrating what got fragmented, what got fractured, what shut down, what got numb, what got tight. These were all, as we talked about a minute ago, strategic defenses to keep ourselves safe. But now they're no longer, they're not integrated. They're parts of us that remain fragmented, remain dissociated, remain numb. So when I work with people, I often give them an experience to feel those places, those uncomfortable places. My throat tightens, my chest hurts, I've got this pain in my sternum. Oh my God, here's my anxiety, it's right at my solar plexus. Ugh, I think about my mom, I feel nauseous in my stomach. You know, these early defenses. I want to push her away with my hands. Those early defenses are fragmentations. and they need to be integrated. So what I might do with someone is say, put your hand here where you had that nausea. Put your other hand here where you felt that numbness or that dissociation or that tightness. And tell those young parts of you, I've got you, and I'll breathe with you until you feel held and seen and safe. Mom couldn't see us. She was too distracted. But I see you, and I'll breathe with you until you feel held and seen and safe, until we integrate back into our bodies, until we can feel pulsing, until we can feel tingling, until we can feel our blood flowing. And then we exhale into those uncomfortable places, Todd, just like you know, and I know, and all of us who've done this deep work. We exhale into those places and hold them in our kind attention, in our compassionate attention, until they feel seen, and then can melt into integration. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah, it does indeed. This is probably a contentious, possibly contentious area, but what is your experience with antipsychotic medications and how they can affect this healing journey? If someone is, again, to use that term, quote unquote, depressed, and they're put on medication for that, is that interfering with the potential gateway to healing?
Not if it helped them gain ground initially. So the idea is, if we're dissociated or living outside of our bodies, and the Seroquel or the SSRI allowed us to have some semblance of peace so we can even begin to have a body, then I'm all for it. But ultimately, I'm not for drugs that take us away from our center. I think the best drug is our own attunement to our own hurt, fragmented, dissociated, tight, anxious parts. So I'm a believer in, if we have anxiety, hold that anxiety, be with that anxiety. It's a young, fragmented part of you that thinks the best way to heal is to be disembodied, or to fragment, or to tighten so deeply that you become hypoxic in that area of your body, and disease process begins to start because you're not in it. So always get into your own body, hold, breathe into, exhale into what's uncomfortable, until that part begins to trust that you'll show up and begins to soften. Mm-hmm. So if initially an SSRI helps somebody, great.
Right.
But the long term, no. Long term, absolutely not. Long term, it's, and I'm not a doctor, I can't comment on SSRIs. Mm-hmm. I can't comment on medications in this way, but in my experience, in my opinion, what I've seen, the best medicine is our own attention to what's uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, I think you said it well when you said anything that takes us away from our consciousness, basically, which medication certainly can do, is going to potentially interrupt the opportunity that we have to heal. And anytime things get uncomfortable, well, that's the opportunity that's presenting itself. If we choose
exactly, there's
to
the
sit
doorway
with that.
There's the doorway for your medicine. What's uncomfortable? Being able to sit with that, to hold that, to talk with that, to comfort that, because maybe when we were little, our parents could not. Mm-hmm. So we have to learn to parent our own parts. But those are the doorway into the great medicine, which is our own attunement into mm-hmm. those parts, until we can be unified and integrated back in our core.
Mm-hmm. Last night I was having dinner on the beach with some families, and we were having a great conversation about an enjoyable sense, but an intriguing conversation about what's going on in the world today and traumatic responses and how they differ from individual to individual. And whereas somebody might be feeling fear primarily right now, another might be feeling anger, another might be feeling disappointment or sadness. And I was noticing as we were all sharing what is coming up for us that it is unique to each individual, and it is probably related to not only our journey with our psyche, but our connection to our parents, and as you described, the intergenerational connection.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring that up. And when you say each of us has his or her own experience, given what's happening today, a lot of this is predicated on what happened to us early, in utero or in those first few years of life, and we don't even think to go there. But we've got to ask these questions, because maybe we have a break in the attachment that we've never really we haven't gone into, opened the door of what broke the bond, what happened when we were in the womb, what happened when we were in utero, what happened when we were infant. Let's say in utero, a baby died before us, and that baby died miscarried or stillborn, and our mother thought we would die too, and she pulled her attention away from the pregnancy because fear distracted her, or she told herself, I don't feel the baby's kicking, something's wrong, and that can break the bond. Or maybe early in the pregnancy, our mom wasn't going to keep us for the first month or two or three, and that broke the bond. Or maybe our parents were fighting or separating or drinking or cheating, or dad was an alcoholic and mom wasn't feeling supported, or she didn't love our father, or she felt trapped in the marriage, or they were worried about money or shelter or food, or nowadays, the pandemic. And in other words, mom must be supported when she's pregnant. She must be supported to be able to be calm, to calm the fetus. We know within 20 days of pregnancy, that which will become our nervous system, the neural tube and the neural groove, is already embodied in the fetus.
Wow,
the heart
20 days.
Is 20 days. The heart is developed within 20 days. So babies are having, infants, fetuses are having somatic experiences, but you know, who is it? I think it might be Bruce Lipton or Chamberlain who says that, I think it's Bruce Lipton who says attunement must begin at conception.
Mm-hmm.
Attunement must begin at conception. Think about that, right? What happens if our mom's dad died, our mom's mom died, her best friend died? All this translates into cortisol, which is caustic to the fetus. So caustic that a fetus even develops a cortisol busting enzyme just to survive mom's stress.
Hmm. And just that, having that part of our biology being formed within 20 days just makes me think about how many mothers don't even recognize that they're pregnant within this time period. So many moms will, and dads too, will make a shift in consciousness when they know they are bringing a new child into the world. But if these things are already formed within 20 days, like there's too much to work on within that amount of time.
Yes.
Especially if you're not even aware.
Exactly. That's why we've asked these questions. What happened to our mother when she was in utero? What happened to our dad when he was in utero? And also, what happened in the first 3 to 5 to 8 to 10 years of life when we're building that attachment to our mother?
Now, with these attachments and the bonds, in your opinion, what do you think the mask wearing is doing? Because what I see and feel in my own body is that I have a very difficult time attaching to somebody, getting to know someone, having a conversation with someone, if there is that barrier, because it takes away the humanity to an extent.
The social engagement, the social engagement system of the expressions of the face, absolutely. Luckily, mothers aren't wearing masks at home with their babies.
Hopefully not.
Because if they were, that would be big time trouble. But yes, exactly right. Mask wearing, boy, oh boy. It certainly doesn't allow us to have full engagement, is the best I can say.
Mm-hmm. And as far as the traumas that we're experiencing right now, because there's probably very few humans alive right now who aren't going through some sort of trauma. How can we deal with this? Is this, again, going back and dealing with our own intergenerational trauma and the way that we are kind of wired so that we can heal that?
Yes.
And therefore, we will better be able to sit with anything that comes our way.
Yes, the pandemic is clearly stirring the pot, so to speak. It's heating the container that we all share. But given our own individual early traumas in our childhood or generational traumas, it's creating for us, for someone who has abandonment and isolation issues from their history, they're feeling very isolated. Someone who doesn't is using that time to write a book or play music, right?
Right.
But the traumas of the pandemic are clearly stirring the pot of what's unresolved in our family history and or our early childhood history. Absolutely.
Which is a beautiful opportunity for all of us.
Yes.
If we can recognize it. Yeah.
Yes. If there's a positive side to the pandemic, if there is, then what it might be doing is, again, stirring that pot and pointing us to look back at our family history or to look back at our early childhood and to say, why am I feeling this isolated? Why am I feeling this fearful? What is the fear? What am I afraid of will happen? And, you know, that can open the door. It's that question that I ask in the book. What's your worst fear?
Yeah.
What's the worst thing that could happen to you? One of the questions I ask, if things suddenly fell apart, if things went terribly wrong, if things went south, and the answer to that question gives you a ton of information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I love that perspective of this can be an opportunity. It is an opportunity. And if millions, potentially hundreds of millions or billions are willing to take up that opportunity, the healing that we could have on a global scale is just unfathomable. And the beauty that could come from that is incredible. And I certainly hope that's the direction things go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Still to be determined, I'm sure.
Yeah, still to be determined. A lot's happening right now, as we know, in the world. You know, people have become fractured.
Yeah.
And that's what concerns me, because when we go back to my book, we see that it's unfortunate right now. Not all information is allowed to be part of the conversation. We have some ideas that are deemed misinformation. And whenever you have censorship and suppression and suppression of information, coercion, you don't get a wholesome dialogue. Mm-hmm. You don't have two sides. And that's what concerns me in my book. You know, I say that no person, no idea can be pushed away or excluded for any reason whatsoever, because it'll only submerge underground and then get rerouted and resurface later on with more urgency.
Yes.
And so that's what concerns me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. When you do that, you get into hot water, and then you see dark facets of history repeating itself.
Yes.
need I say more?
Yeah. And just the divisiveness that is kind of among us now, and probably in a capacity that has never been before. And it's either you're on board or you're not with whatever the idea is. And it's
we're on the brink, perhaps, of a dark time in history. And mm-hmm. You know, if I, given my field of study, inherited trauma, generational trauma, if I have one thing to say, you know, it's don't exclude anybody. Don't exclude any idea. Don't push away any element of the conversation. Don't submerge. Don't silence. Don't fracture. This can be a valuable time for conversation, so new ideas can be brought to the forefront.
Well, and I think if we consider like the alchemical perspective of we've got to go to the darkness to find the light. The spiritualists are saying that this is a very challenging time, but from that is going to emerge a whole new level of consciousness. and just this concept that we've been talking about of this is our dark night of the soul. This is our time to sit with that tension, to hold it, and something new and magnificent will emerge if we're able to do that collectively.
Very well said, Todd. I have nothing to add to that sentence. I would completely agree with it.
I want to go back to what you were saying about this core wound, this question about what's the worst thing that can happen. Because what I love how in the book you talk about what's underneath that. And when someone gives an answer, it's like, okay, well, let's sit with that. Let's sit with that scenario. Why is that so fearful for you? And typically what we find is underneath that, there's some layers, not typically, always, there's some layers of trauma that just haven't been healed. And if we can heal those, we can start to realize that, oh yeah, that's actually not such a terrible thing. Yeah, it's not great. I don't want to do it. But within that is an opportunity.
Yeah, that question, what's your worst fear, leads us into what I call core language or trauma language. And I've discovered that when a trauma happens, clues are left behind in the form of emotionally charged words and sentences that leave a breadcrumb trail, just like you said. And when we learn to follow that breadcrumb trail, it's like finding the missing piece of the puzzle, which allows the whole picture to come into view and then can finally give us a context of why we feel the way we feel. And if I elaborate, you know, it's essential that we listen for our own trauma language, because as we know from trauma theory, when a traumatic event happens, significant information bypasses the frontal lobes. So the experience of exactly what happened to us, it can't be named or ordered through words because our language centers become compromised. And without language, our experiences become stored as fragments, those fragmentations I was talking about, fragments of memory, fragments of body sensation, fragments of emotion, fragments of images, fragments of language. It's like the mind disperses and essential elements get separated. We lose the story, Todd, and we never complete the healing. Yet, you know, what I found is these pieces are never lost. They simply get rerouted and then resurface into what I call verbal trauma language or nonverbal trauma language. When it's verbal, you know, like I said earlier, it's a sentence like, I'll do something terrible. I'll be hated. I'm a bad person. I'll be punished. I'll be abandoned. I'll be ostracized. I'll be rejected. I'll go crazy. I'll be locked up. That's verbal trauma language. But when it's nonverbal, I teach my students to look for the physical or emotional symptoms that show up after, you know, some type of unsettling event in our lives. So we might look for the fears or the anxieties that strike suddenly when we reach a particular age, maybe age 30. And we don't even realize why it's hitting us at that age. But age 30 is when grandma loses grandpa. She becomes a widow. Or that's the same age our mom left our dad or our dad left our mom. Something traumatic happens. But it's not just ages. You know, we might look for a depression or a destructive behavior that arises right after a situation that's similar to another situation that happened in our family history. It's not just even, I know I said a mouthful there, but it's to make it more simplistic, you know, we don't even have to look that far. Nonverbal trauma language, it's also mirrored in our relationship struggles. Who we choose, the type of partner we choose, how we let ourselves be treated, how we treat others. It's also right there mirrored in how we deal with money and success. All of this forms a breadcrumb trail that we need to follow.
Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad you brought up the age thing, because that's something that I had written down here, because you give numerous examples in the book about an age being reached, something happening with an individual, and then through this detective work, you're able to help them recognize that, okay, this something similar happened to mom at the same age or to grandma at the same age. Why is that? Because in the examples that you give, it's like spot on. At 22 years of age, this has happened through three generations or something similar. How is it that that is kind of connected with our development in such a precise way?
That's somewhat of a mystery, actually, but we do know that memories get imprinted in sperm cells and egg cells, and somehow this information passes forward. You know, people, but why ages? Isn't it interesting that that happens? I've been watching this for 30 years. You know, so we could be born with an anxiety or a depression, and we never separate it from the events of the previous generation. But just like you're saying, we can experience a symptom or a fear or an anxiety at a certain age, and it's the same age that something happened to our mom or our dad, as though that trauma somehow became, I wouldn't even know how to explain it other than imprinted, mm-hmm. imprinted is the best thing I can say. It's not just ages. Certain milestones, certain events become right. imprinted. For example, as soon as we get married, that can become a trigger. In the book, I talk about a woman, she loves her fiance. She thinks he's the greatest guy in the world. But as soon as she gets married to him, she feels trapped and she doesn't understand it. She says, I love this guy. He's great, but I'm married and I feel trapped in my marriage. And then when we looked in her family history, we saw she was from, I think, Iraq or Lebanon. We saw that both grandmothers had been given away as child brides at 9 and 12 to much older men, 30, 40 years older. And it was so interesting because I looked at the traumas of both of her sisters too, Todd. The one sister married a much older man, 30 years older, and the other sister wouldn't even get involved in relationships at all, lest she be trapped. So it expressed differently in each sibling. So ages are one. Marriage is a trigger. That's another. Another trigger is moving to a new place. So all of a sudden, we pack our bags and we move just across town. But now we're depressed and we don't understand it. And what it's hearkening back to is our ancestors who were persecuted and forced out of their homeland. Maybe they were executed or persecuted or suffered deeply. And our moving somehow taps into that pull of imprinted energy from the sperm cell, the egg cell. I'll give you another one. We get rejected by a partner. And that's the trigger. And all of a sudden, we may have only dated this person 2 months. And all of a sudden, I can't live without this person. Because it's taking us back to an earlier grief, Todd, a grief that's insurmountable, perhaps even to a break in the bond with our mother when we lost her. Mm-hmm. I'll give you another one. I mean, I could go on and on all day doing this, but having a child, that's another trigger. I one time worked with this woman who was consumed with anxiety, and she didn't know where it was coming from. And I said, how long have you had it? She goes, 7 months. What happened 7, 8 months ago? Well, that's when I got pregnant. I said, you mean you're pregnant now? She said, yes, I am. And all of a sudden, this ancestral alarm clock starts ringing as soon as she becomes pregnant. I ask her that question. What's the worst thing that could happen if you have a child? And immediately, Todd, she says, I could harm my child. I could harm my baby. And I said, have you ever harmed a baby? She said, no, of course not. And I said, did anyone in your family ever harm a baby? And in that moment, in that second, she's about to say no. She goes, oh my God. She says, my grandmother, when she was a young woman, she lit a candle in the house and caught the curtains on fire. And then the house caught on fire and she couldn't get the baby out. And the baby died. The baby was upstairs. But we were never allowed to talk about it. And here's the censorship. But we were never allowed to talk about it. You never talked to my grandmother about that. You walked on eggshells around my grandmother. And in that moment, she makes the link that she had inherited the terror, the actual terror from her grandmother through the egg cell, sperm cell, whatever side it would be on. And in that moment, we're able to break the pattern.
I'm so glad you shared that particular example, because just in the recognition of this not being my trauma or the person's trauma, they can actually let it go. And that's what you talk about a lot. In some cases, there's the opportunity there. Yeah.
Yes. In some cases, that's very true. The recognition alone is like, you mean this isn't me? You mean this isn't my trauma? And sometimes I sit with people going, and I say, no, never was. You mean it's not me who will lose a child? Nope, your grandmother lost those two babies. And sometimes that's enough. But other times, of course, we have to work somatically because the trauma has embedded deeper in the body, and it takes a physicalized somatic experience, a visceral experience to release trauma.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk also about another aspect of your work. One of my friends and a past guest, Michael Schieser, does family constellation work, and I've participated in that with him. Both you and he have studied under Bert Hellinger and the family constellation side of things. Can you talk a bit about what family constellations are and how that can be a useful tool in healing trauma?
Yeah, so a family constellation is sort of it's like a group experience where there's several people in the room. For me, I do family constellations in groups of 120, 150 people. Wow. So there's all these people in a big circle in the room, or two circles, or in the audience, and you're inviting people to stand as family members, images. So it's an inner image that's expressed in an outer experience. So I might say, Todd, pick somebody from the room to stand as your dad, and pick someone else to stand as his father who left him when he was three. And so you put those two men in the room. And I might even say, hey, Todd, pick somebody to stand as you in the room. And then in doing this, at this point, it allows us to shift an old image we carry of dad's dad is bad guy. Because we might see behind grandpa, he was given away at birth. I might then ask, what happened to your grandpa? And you go, oh, he was an orphan. I go, oh, no wonder he left his family, because his family left him. And all of a sudden, your mouth drops open and you go, oh, I never thought about that. I was only thinking my grandpa was a bad guy and never thinking of the complete story. So what a family constellation does is it allows us to complete the whole story. So we use healing images, healing movements, healing sentences, and body-centered releases to help people break patterns of suffering. And then to help them really shift the stress response, change the brain. It's an extremely powerful tool. And in a constellation, literally we step into this new image of feeling whole, feeling complete. And afterward, we find ourselves standing in a much stronger place, a much clearer place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found it's a very powerful tool. You spoke a number of times about the censorship within families about traumas. We never talk about that. What is the danger in never talking about these things?
Repetition. That's the whole problem. Whenever we exclude something, look. People always ask me, Mark, why do these traumas repeat? What's going on? Why is it falling into the next generation? Epigenetics is just one. Another question is, not everybody is manifesting inherited trauma. Why am I? Why is this? Why is my brother not, but I am? Epigenetics is just one piece of the puzzle. Just like we talked about earlier, embryologists have known for over 100 years that our grandmother, when she's pregnant with our mother, is holding our mother's eggs, and one of those eggs is us. We know that. And Bruce Lipton is telling us that a mother's emotions are chemically communicated to the fetus through the placenta. So our mother's feelings are important. So we know that, because that can biochemically alter genetic expression. But there's a deeper, well, I don't want to say deeper. There's another facet that seems to anchor traumas, and that's rejection. And when traumas aren't talked about, when the healing is incomplete, when the pain or the grief or the embarrassment or the shame is too great that we don't want to touch it. We don't want to feel it. We don't want to touch those memories. Or the people in our family history are excluded or rejected. We don't like our mother because she wasn't kind. We don't like our father because he hit us. We don't like our grandfather because he was an alcoholic. And we exclude people. And when we exclude these people, so what I see, basically, when there's not been any resolution, when these rejections, these exclusions continue to proliferate, what I see is then these then aspects of these traumas can appear, can show up in later generations, and unconsciously will repeat or share a similar unhappiness, a similar misfortune, until the trauma finally has a chance to heal. I brought up Freud earlier. I'll go back to Freud now. Freud noticed, he observed this 100 years ago when he talked about repetition compulsion, that the contraction of the trauma is actually seeking its expansion.
And so when we label certain people and certain acts and we say, we don't talk about granddad or granddad was a bad guy, and we then tell that to our children, and then they go on to tell that to their children, it's just something where it's just a given without there ever being any investigation into it. And I'm assuming that as a child who's been told granddad is a bad guy, there's a greater chance that when that child becomes a granddad, he is not going to have the experience or the language even to understand how to be a good granddad.
Absolutely. And even if granddad's an alcoholic, or he left grandma with five kids and he died on the streets, what they call, the family called him a loser. Someone else can become that loser. Somebody else can become that alcoholic. Somebody else can repeat grandpa's life experience to bring him back into the fold, so to speak. Why does that happen? I would say there's another dynamic that we don't quite understand, and I would call it something like unconscious loyalty. Unconscious loyalty, where the later generations are bringing back to consciousness some earlier experience of a victim or a perpetrator or a loser or an alcoholic, and all of a sudden repeating facets of that person's experience. Again, if you ask me why I think that's true, I would say no one, nothing is allowed to be excluded or left out. And when you leave someone out of the family system, even energetically, that void gets filled energetically by someone who behaves the same way.
Right.
It's startling, but we see it. You can't deny it. We see it.
And that's why in the family constellation work, it's important that people even play the roles of the perpetrators who maybe are not within the family tree, but someone who harmed granddad or someone who stole from mom or whatever the situation may be. If we exclude them,
even the perpetrators have to be included, because we can identify. So in my book, I talked about the four themes, and one of those themes is identification. Meaning we can identify, live like, feel like, behave like someone who's been excluded in the family, our alcoholic grandfather, someone who murdered our aunt, someone who the Nazis who perpetrated on our Jewish ancestors, the granddad drove the bicycle or drove the car, backed the car down the driveway and accidentally ran over the kid, the five-year-old boy on the bicycle. Everybody has to be brought back into the family history so they can be acknowledged and seen as members of our family, because people who harmed our family become part of the family system. Mm-hmm. Family or people we've harmed become part of our family system. I talk about that in the book at great length.
Yeah, and it's also important to honor and recognize lost family members, including those who were never born, stillborn, or miscarried.
Absolutely.
To bring them into it, because as you said, some people may then end up carrying that feeling of I'm not wanted, or I don't belong, because perhaps they had a sibling who died a decade earlier.
You very well put, Todd. So just to say more about that, if we had a brother or sister that died stillborn or died as a, you know, lived only a couple days and mom can't talk about it. In fact, they give the child often the next name. They say, oh, little Tommy came back. So mm-hmm. I named you Tommy, just like this, your brother. In other words, this older brother Tommy's excluded. And the parent thinks that the next child is the same child who's come back without honoring that first child. The second child who comes after can feel as though he doesn't fit in, as though he's not seen, as though he doesn't belong, just like the first child. Mm-hmm. We see this all the time. Yeah.
One of my closest friends, he and his wife lost a child after only minutes, and they now have three children who are alive. But when asked, they always say they have four children.
Absolutely.
Three who are here and one who's no longer. And I think
very good practice.
Yeah. Yeah. Every time I hear him say that, I'm like, wow, that's incredible. Just to help heal these wounds and not have it become something that is not spoke of and manifest in other ways.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
Mark, your journey into this, as you hinted at earlier, has been one not free of trauma, and you write about it in your book. And I think it's a very, it's a great example of what someone needs to go through to heal. Can you talk a bit about what you experienced on your healing journey?
Sure. So probably over 30 years ago, I had symptoms I couldn't explain. I began to lose the vision in one of my eyes. And I was diagnosed with a chronic form of retinopathy. The doctors couldn't cure it. And I had it in both eyes. And they told me that the way it was progressing, I would likely lose the vision in my other eye as well. And I was frantic. I'm in my 30s at this point, and my early 30s, I'm 31, and I'm, you know, terrified. And because I think I'm going to be blind, and, you know, and I was desperate to find help, and the doctors couldn't give it to me. I kept asking, what do I do? And they'd say, we don't know very much about this condition. We just think it's stress. And so everything I tried to do to alleviate stress wasn't working. Everything seemed to make it worse. So I calmed down and I went on a sort of a healing journey. I went on a search for healing that led me halfway around the globe, following wise men and women, and trying to learn what wisdom they held. And literally, I went as far as places like Indonesia, where I learned from several wise teachers who taught me some fundamental principles, one of which was the importance of healing our relationship with our parents. Mine was terribly broken. And before I could heal with my parents, I had to heal what stood in the way, which was inherited family trauma. But I didn't know it at this time, specifically the anxiety that I had inherited from my grandparents, who were all orphaned. All my grandparents are orphaned in some way. Three of them lose their mothers when they're babies, and the fourth one loses her father when she's a baby. So ultimately, she loses her mother too, in the grief. And this anxiety was the real cause of my vision loss. And as did my parents, I had inherited this feeling of being this feeling of being broken from a mother's love. Oh man, I remember this was what was passed down to my family. I remember being a small boy, 5 or 6 years old, running into my mother's bedroom whenever she'd leave the house. And I'd pull open her drawers of clothing, and I'd cry into her scarves and her nightgowns, thinking that I'd never see her again, and that her smell would be the only thing that I had left, which would have been true for my grandparents, who only did have maybe a garment with their mother's smell. And then 40 years later, I shared this with my mom. I said, you know, Mom, whenever you'd leave the house, I would cry into your clothes. And she said, oh, I did that too when my mom would leave the house. And then my sister, reading my book, said, honey, I did that too when Mom would leave the house. And I realized the family pattern was thinking we'd never see our mothers again. which had been true for our grandparents. So after healing the broken bond with my mom, Todd, I swear to God, my sight came back. My vision came back. And then I said, uh-oh, there's something in this healing that really works. So I'm going to teach these principles. I'm going to teach the principle of healing with our parents. And along the way, I developed a method for healing the effects of inherited family trauma.
Mm-hmm. There are two things that come up for me on that. One is the vision loss. Were you going through something at that point in life where you felt kind of hopeless, where you didn't have a vision for the future, and the vision loss was a manifestation of that?
Yeah, you know, I guess you could say that. You know, I guess you could say, but I didn't discover that really till I lost my vision.
Yeah.
So sometimes we don't find ourselves until we suffer, until we hit a dark night of the soul. And yes, I would find later that there were events in my life where I was living outside of myself, outside of my integrity or myself, my selfness, my knowing of myself. And I would discover that later, but I didn't know it at the time. It actually took, for many of us, a great suffering to go into those places that are uncomfortable that we talked about earlier in the podcast.
Right. And if I recall correctly, your healing journey with your mother kind of started with a hug, didn't it?
You bring up a good point. My mom, I remember I'm going back to Pennsylvania, to Pittsburgh to be exact, to heal with my parents. And I'm really broken from my parents. And, you know, I had this image that, God, I couldn't stand when my mother hugged me, that if she hugged me, I felt like my body would implode. It felt so terrible because I had early trauma with her in the womb and as an infant. So my body had rejected her love. So here I am going back, and I'm knowing she's going to hug me. And I'm thinking, oh, God, what am I going to do? And I had this insight that said, be with it. Let her hug you and stay with what's uncomfortable in your body. And I did that. As she's hugging me, I said, Mom, keep hugging me. Mom, don't stop. Because I was really getting a handle on how my body was shutting down and how I was going numb and how I was getting tight and I was feeling anxious. And all this was coming to light as she was hugging me. And that's where I developed this exercise of hugging our partner, because our mother is the partner and our partner is the mother.
Hmm. Our mother is the partner and our partner is the mother.
Yeah. Hmm. Our mother's our first relationship.
Yeah.
Our mother's the only one with whom we're in connection in utero. We're in relationship with her smells, her scents, her rhythms, her pulses, her sounds. This is our first relationship. And when there's breaks at this is before, this is when our dad is felt as tertiary. Yeah. He's felt on the outside. How he is with our mother is felt again through our mother in utero.
And any break in that bond, no matter how even subtle it may seem, such as a child spending a night in the hospital for a procedure,
yeah,
that can have ramifications much later
in
life,
if our parents have
generations.
Exactly. There. Yeah, if our parents take an early vacation and they leave us home for a week or two when we're two or three or four or five, or our mom gets sick, goes to the hospital, or our parents cart us off to grandma's for the summer, or even leave us at grandma's for a week or two when we're too little, or when our parents split up and we go back and forth to mother and father, but we're too young, we can't be away from our mother when we're too young. So yes, all these things leave imprints, leave wounds.
Oh, Mark, this is incredible work. And I've, as I said in the beginning, it didn't start with you. The book is such a treasure. And I hope everyone reads it, because there is healing to be had no matter who you are. I can almost guarantee there are traumas that have not been healed. And the book is just a great portal into recognizing that and taking steps. It's so practical and so laid out so well that someone can not only start to make these connections, but they can then take it to the next level, which is start to heal these breaks. And I commend you for it, and I thank you so much for bringing that book to life for everyone and just the work that you do in general.
Thank you, Todd. Thank you so much.
What are you currently working on?
I'm working on a book of complex illness, complex symptoms, complex conditions, and how they also relate to early trauma, either ours or our parents or grandparents.
What do you mean by complex?
Lyme, mold, you know, the symptoms that are very difficult to treat, mast cell activation, you know, the POTS. I mean, we can go on and on because the list, chronic fatigue, I mean, we can go on and on. But many of us now, our systems are breaking down and we find ourselves struggling with what we first think are environmental toxins and are, and perhaps there's even a deeper component where our early environment was also compromised.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like a lot of this is the manifestations of physical symptoms that are connected to the emotional traumas?
Absolutely. You know, I've been living in this realm of, but this book's been sitting with me for very long, and I'm now in the process of being on sabbatical and writing it so I can bring it out to the public.
Mm-hmm. Is your vision loss an example of this?
Oh, absolutely. It would be an example of this. But I don't think I'll go beyond my own story here and talk about what many of us are experiencing great suffering right now in healing and losing of our body's ability to just keep us functioning. It's quite common, as you know, you as well being in the medical field.
Yeah. Well, those symptoms are so important to be listened to. And yet, as we spoke earlier, our societal reaction is to avoid those things that make us uncomfortable, and that includes symptoms. And so we have a whole barrage of medications that are antipsychotic, anti-inflammatory, antidepressive. And when we take that, we're basically just snuffing out the symptoms. And those symptoms have so much meaning behind them and so much potential to help guide us. And you talked about the breadcrumbs. They are our breadcrumbs to healing.
You couldn't have said it better. Absolutely. They are the doorway. They are the guideposts. They are the direction signs. They hand us in such specificity what's happened and how to heal. Mm-hmm. They shine the light.
And I've seen people close to me, example, diagnosis of cancer. I've seen one person recognize that lifestyle and thoughts and the trauma and the stress that this individual carried was part of this journey. And when this individual got cancer, there was great healing of all of these traumas before, and the cancer became a great gift. And yet I've seen other people who the cancer is the enemy to be stamped out no matter what the cost, and there is no reflection and no internal work done whatsoever. It's just, let's hit it aggressively with whatever we can hit it with and blast it out and carry on.
Oh, absolutely. Even that word, I'll battle this cancer, I'll fight this cancer, mm-hmm. keeps us in fight flight, keeps us in a state where we can't reach our vulnerability and go deeper. Well put, Todd.
And that can be with anything, and it doesn't have to be something as life-threatening as cancer. In your case, it was losing your vision. These symptoms are not trivial. No matter what they are, they're not trivial. Mark, where can people learn more about you and potentially have the opportunity to, I don't know if you're still working with clients, I think you are, and where can we send people to?
Yeah, join me or come over to my website and Mark Wolyn, WOLYNN.com. And there you'll, you know, if you want to learn about this work, if you're a clinician, I have a training I just taught that I'm very proud of. Where I teach people, it's streamable. You can just buy it right on my website or work with me or one of the people I've trained working with the effects of early trauma, inherited trauma. It's all there on the website. Also, we're on social media too.
Okay, great. And I don't want to put any pressure on you, but is there an expected date for the book? Or expected season or year?
You know how books go, right? They write you, you don't write them. So each day I add to it and I add to it. And
it's in process.
Yeah, it's in process.
Okay, yeah. Great.
Oh, I hope soon. I mean, I've got the bulk of it down and I hope soon.
Yeah. Well, and this is timeless work that you're doing. And so no matter how many years go by between the first book and the next one, this information doesn't grow old. And it's not like, oh, we can, that's no longer relevant. We're on to the next best thing. Now, healing our traumas and our inherited traumas, it's going to be relevant forever.
Oh, yeah. The book that's out there now is absolutely relevant. I stand behind everything in it. And it's current with the science and leading people. You know, that's the whole thing I'm trying to do in this book. Let me take your hand and walk you through what's either your worst symptoms, your worst fears, and let's see where we can go together on this journey. And along the way, let's find your trauma language, verbal and nonverbal. Let's link it. Let's do your core language map. Let's do your genogram, your traumagram. And then let's have some practices and exercises so we can begin to heal and stay with where we're uncomfortable till we can strike gold beneath.
Well said. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this today and sharing your wealth of knowledge. You just had some amazing parting words. We can leave it at that. Is there anything else you want to leave the listeners with on their healing path?
Well, okay. I would say that if we find ourselves struggling in any way with relationship failures or unexplained symptoms or failures with career or money or depression or anxiety, OCD, phobias, destructive behaviors, self-sabotaging behaviors, you know, we've got to shake the family tree, you know, really, you know, and see what falls out. You know, ask ourselves what family secrets have been hidden that we remember hearing once or twice as children, but nobody talks about, or what stories didn't get told all the way. If our parents are alive, ask them, Dad, what happened when you were in Korea? What happened when you were in Vietnam? Or what traumas never healed all the way? Hey, Mom, what happened when you were a little girl? You told me you were sent to grandma's. When? For how long? Or Mom, what happened to me when I was little? You know, we've got to find out if we can these things, because it's helpful just to be able to say, oh, that's what happened. But even if we don't know, that information is contained in our trauma language and in our behaviors. And in the book, I teach us, even without knowing any information, how to find it. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
No, thank you, Todd, for having me. You're a lovely guy. It was really nice to talk to you during the show and before the show. And I hope our paths cross again.
I hope so, too. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Salish Wolf with Mark Wolin. To learn more about Mark, visit markwolin.com. That's markwolynn.com. And pick up a copy of his book, It Didn't Start With You, wherever books are sold. Please check out anchorpointexpeditions.com for all episodes of this podcast and for information on my men's leadership retreats, men's group, and personal development coaching. This show was produced by me, Todd Howard. Music was written and performed by Jason Kaus of the Darcys. Special thanks to Pacific Rim College for their ongoing contribution to the show. For episodes on holistic health and sustainability, please tune into my other podcast, Pacific Rim College Radio, at pacificrimcollege.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give it a 5-star rating on whatever podcast app you are using and share it with your friends and family. If there is a guest you would like to recommend for the show, please email discover@anchorpointexpeditions.com. You have been listening to Salish Wolf. I am Todd Howard, signing off.